that you put a sort of compendium type of presentation together with a number of different members of the School of Economics being involved in its presentation. Mark will be the first one tonight, and we would like to discuss just a few things during the course of the next week about economics. I think if people think about economics, you often get this reaction, I often get it, and that is, oh, that's so hard. When I did it at university, it was terrible. But economics has become very, very relevant over the past number of years, and it's become very much part of our lives, with different economic crises around the world taking place, things very much unresolved at this point in time in Europe, changing balances of power in terms of economics happening between the traditional West and the traditional East. And there's a lot of exciting things happening around the world from an economic perspective. Also in terms of South Africa, we've got lots of very, very interesting challenges, exciting challenges, some very difficult challenges. In terms of macroeconomics, many of the things over the past 17 or so years have become much better. If we think about revenue collection, if we think about government finances, there have been major improvements over the past 17 years. However, at a micro level, there are huge challenges. Challenges at educational level, at industrialization level, at the level of bargaining, where there are huge, huge challenges that are still remaining till today, and where the options and the solutions are not necessarily clear for everyone. So it's within this context that the School of Economics wants to put this set of lectures together. My colleague tonight is Dr. Mark Elaine. Dr. Elaine has joined us from the International Monetary Fund about 2 years ago. He's a very much appreciated new member of staff in the School of Economics. While he was at the IMF, he was a country economist in African countries for a period of 20 years. And we are delighted to have him in the department. Also, he will be talking very much in terms of the international arena in which South Africa is operating. From tomorrow onwards, the focus will be more on South Africa and the challenges that we are faced as South Africans, specifically focusing on those things where my colleagues in the school have had some experience in terms of research and in terms of placing their focus. So without any further ado, I'm going to give the chair to Mark Elaine, and I hope that you will enjoy the time and the lecture with him. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Corné. And you kept it short as you promised. We're going to try to cover a lot of ground tonight because I want to talk to you about a lot of aspects about what's going on in the world around us during this period of time. And it may go a little fast at times. Everybody has a different level of knowledge. I'm going to ask that if we try to keep the questions to the end. So let me show you what we're... Already my computer is acting up. This is what we're going to try to do tonight. Do you hear me? Yes. Is first look at the world around us and some of the economic trends of the past, let's say, 30 years. I'm going to give you a little bit of economic background about how crises move from one country to another. What is the magic of these economic, we call it the economic transmission. And then I want to look at three big crises that have affected the world in the past few years. You've heard of and seen the subprime crisis, which was this international financial crisis. The euro crisis in Greece, we're experiencing right now. And I'm going to talk to you about something called the international imbalances. That's some imbalances that are going on in the world. Notably between the United States and China, but it describes one of the underlying problems that faces the international system. Now, you know, many people think that economics, you know, sometimes economics looks like magic, and that's one of the things that I wanted to demonstrate for you tonight. And I thought I'd give you a bit of an illustration about how economics works. Sometimes we say money is like water, And it sort of lubricates the system, the economic system. Things like, oh, yeah, we have to have enough money in the system. It always finds its way to places where it's needed. And the problem for economists is sometimes when you don't have enough money, or if you have too much money, then the job is that we have to get rid of it and buy it all.
Okay.
let's take a look at where the world is. Sorry, I connect myself up again. All right. One of the first messages is that the world is growing a lot. Now, what does this mean? The first obvious point is population, and if we look at the world population over on the right-hand side, and that's this big world line. In 1960, the world population was about just over 3 billion, close to 3, and a little over 3 billion. Today, it's just about 7 billion. So this has been a huge expansion in the world population. Recent growth rates of people at 1.5% per annum means that in another 50 years, this population is going to double again, and we're going to have, instead of 7 billion, in 50 years, we'll have 14 billion. But we want to look at some trends, too, because that's part of the message. Who's growing fast? Well, this is Europe. The regions have the populations on this side, but it's the slope of that line that matters. Europe's not growing. It's pretty flat. Asia is growing fast. And sub-Saharan Africa is also growing fast. And that's going to be very important for Africa in the future.
Population is also workforce. It's a good thing.
Let's look at incomes. And the way we measure income is we take the GDP, the gross domestic product of the country, we divide it by the number of people, and sort of an approximation for income per person. Don't forget we're dividing it by children, babies, retired people, and so forth. But it gives us an indication. Now, let's look first at the United States. That's the right-hand side, where income per person is something on the order of $40,000. Stick. The rest of the world, we have to look at this axis. And I should say, the United States never applied to Europe. Europe is something similar to that. The rest of the world, in fact, the world average, well, in 1969 it was $4,000. Today it's about $7,000. But let's look at something like sub-Saharan Africa, where you'll notice the income, instead of growing over time, has actually been flat or actually gone down a bit. Africa's had a very bad few decades, and we're talking about an income per person of $1,000. Another area that you want to look at, because it's the slope of that line, which tells us how fast it's growing, if we look at Asia, which includes China and India, you'll see this is an area which is growing very fast, from under $1,000 to over $3,000 during the same period. So what we're seeing is a little bit of a shift in geography of where the money is in the world, where the economic influence is. And to illustrate this, if we look at the left-hand side here, if we take the world GDP, the whole production of everything in the world, and we spread it out by regions, the so-called the G7 are the big seven industrial countries, Western industrial countries, which is US, Canada, Japan, Germany, France, UK, and Italy. That's the so-called G7. They, in 1980, controlled 55% of the world GDP. Today, they are about 35% of the world GDP. Well, they've been growing, been shrinking is that some other areas of the world are growing faster. And again, when we look at who's growing faster, that line is Asia, which has gone from 10% of the world output to virtually 35% of the world output in the past, in the same 3 decades. Asia includes China, India, and a bunch of other rapidly growing Asian countries, places like Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore. So that is the big change that has happened. And if we look at Africa here, sub-Saharan Africa, its share of world output has stayed about the same. It's really not doing very much. Latin America, it's going up and down a little bit. We've got the Middle East, and this is Eastern Europe and the, I'm forgetting what CIS, but it's the former Soviet countries who broke away from the Soviet Union, and actually it's the Stalin line here. That's why they didn't exist before 1990, and when the Soviet Union broke out, you had a whole bunch of countries from the former Soviet republics. Let's take a look at some individual countries to make a point. Here's the US. 1980, 26% of the world. Today, 23. Well, really, the US is still, hasn't lost a lot. It's still a very big economy. European Union went from 34% to 26%. Went down a lot. South America, again, pretty stable. But let's look at Asia. It went from 6% of world income to 15%. And you can see that a big chunk of that was due to China alone. So in Africa has lost ground. Remember we saw some of the GDP per capita was shrinking a bit. Africa has actually lost share in world economies. And South Africa is about the same. The share of the world is about similar. When your share stays the same, it means you're growing as fast as everybody else. If your share is getting bigger, you're growing a lot faster. If your share is getting smaller, it means you're just growing slower than the other people. Doesn't mean you're getting negative or you're losing anything necessarily. Here's another message I want to make. The world economy is becoming more integrated. And how do we measure integrated? Well, it's an imprecise term, but trade, foreign trade, imports and exports. The more trade you have, that means the more you depend on other countries. Trade is growing even faster than all that GDP growth. International capital flows, money, capital is moving from one country to another, is growing even faster. In the old days, not much capital flowed. And if you think about it, 100 years ago, to move capital from one place to another, you had to put gold bullion on a ship and take the ship someplace with your gold bullion, and that was capital. That was capital. Today, I can do it on a computer. I can move money from the United States to here or any place here quite easily. And certainly, all the advances in telecommunication and the internet makes it easier for investors to make wise decisions to decide to make investments and move money around. So, I think we can safely say the world is becoming a more integrated place. Now, the question is it becoming more volatile? Are today's bad news of all these crises, is this any different than before? And I'm quoting to you, I've got a couple of quotes here from a book written by Kenneth Rogoff, who's a professor at Harvard. He used to be the chief economist at the IMF. And Carmen Reinhart, who's a renowned economist in the United States. They wrote this book called This Time is Different, writing about the current crisis. And at the beginning of the book, they tell a bit of a story that more
There's been four words which have caused more havoc in financial circles than anything else, and it's this time it's different. This time, it really is boom. You know, we're really going to have boom, everything's different, it's not like it was before. And they will go through some two centuries and show, looking at debt crises, different types of debt crises, and have identified at least 250 sovereign defaults. A sovereign default is like Greece not being able to pay its debt, or any other country. And in fact, Greece has had five defaults in the 1800s. It's not new for Greece. It's not the first time they've had problems. And the method, the story basically is this economic cycle of booms and busts, of overheated economies, it's not new. It's happened for a long time. It'll probably continue to happen in the future. Our goal as economists is to try to dampen the shocks, but it's unlikely they're going to go away. Let's look at some volatility as an example. If we take a look at on this left-hand side, that's the price of oil in dollars per barrel. Now, and here's the oil line. And unfortunately, I should have gone back to the 1970s when oil was under $20 a barrel. But during the 1980s and 90s, the price of oil varied from $16 a barrel to almost to $38. It fluctuated and doubled. I mean, you go from 16 to 32, that's 100% increase. So oil prices were even volatile then, and they don't look so bad compared to what we're seeing now, where we've gone from a period of $30 a barrel to $100, or briefly hitting even higher, $100 a barrel. That's three times. Well, you can see by comparison, I've got a line here where these a food index and a metals price are plotted as well, according to the index here. But you can see they're doing some similar things. And certainly recently, they're also shooting up in the last decade, where we've had really sort of a commodities boom. That's since about 2002, where food prices, metal prices, oil prices have all probably doubled or tripled in that time period. But it strikes me that when we looked at the world growth rates of all these different countries, at the end of the day, the world doesn't grow so fast, and countries don't even grow so fast. You can see the average growth rate for the world is somewhere between 0 and 5% for any year. 5% growth is already not so bad. And why do we think it's not bad? We always measure the growth rate versus the population growth rate. If the country is growing faster than its population, everybody is doing better. If it's growing slower than its population, you probably have some problems because some people are falling further behind. So you can look at the population growth rates. In developing countries, maybe population growth rates could be 2 or 3%. In Europe, it's probably 0. In the United States, population growth is probably 1%. It varies a little bit. But the issue is, it's not, and certainly not particularly clear, but during some periods in the 90s, I tried to plot here the different regions' growth, the highest growth in certain regions and the lowest growth, and there were some very wide disparities between what was going on in one region of the world and what was going on in another region. And I think what's happening today is because of the factors that I talked about, that we are living in a more globalized world, more and more globalized, that we're getting a little bit more convergence. But this is an open question. Certainly, as another example, I tried to look at inflation rates in different countries. And this is very messy, but It's just to say, during the 1980s and early 90s, we had some areas where inflation for the whole region was going up to 60-70%. This dashed line there is Africa, and we had some high inflation countries in Africa. The big area, the big inflation areas were, of course, Latin America, where there were, if you think Zimbabwe had high inflation. Well, Zimbabwe holds one of the records, I guess, these days. I think they were well over 100,000% at one point. But Bolivia and several other Latin American countries had huge explosive inflations earlier on. But today, it looks like more and more countries are running single-digit inflation, and we don't seem to see as much disparity. Again, there's a question of whether the world is converging a little bit towards the same trends. So, the observations that I just made to you about the economy, the world is growing pretty strongly, I think. And when I say strongly, if you look back to the Middle Ages, you can see population growth. And you can see income growth rates. You know, when we look at the Middle Ages, everything was flat for hundreds of years. I mean, really, things didn't move so much. So this, I look at 30 years, but I'm talking about this past century. Economic geography is changing, and we know that especially in Asia versus the Western countries, shares of world output is changing. The world is becoming more integrated. We talked about a little bit about these foreign trade and capital flows. But there's still volatility. Probably will never go away. And there's a question, which I can't say, whether we're becoming more convergent or not towards the same trends all over. Now, before I go on and talk to you, we want to get to these international shocks. But I want to give you a little bit of economics about how shocks move from area to area. And there's traditional mechanisms. One is the trade-related, through your imports and exports. Shocks are transmitted, and through financial circles and contagion. So what is this exactly? Well, imports and exports mean Africa sells a lot of things to Europe and the advanced world. When those countries are growing, they suck in a lot of raw materials coming from Africa. So when the industrial world is growing strongly, it keeps exports coming from Africa, and the African economies, it tends to be a motivation. The IMF did an estimate that if those advanced countries, well, in this case, they did it for the whole world, when the world slows down around Africa by 1%, it reduces African growth as well because the countries are no longer demanding African products. Okay? Trade is the traditional way of transferring demand from one country to another. There's some other things. Prices. Africa is a commodity producer for minerals, more and more for oil. International oil prices are set. If they go up, it's good for Africa. If they go down, I mean, it can be good or bad, but the prices tend to be set internationally by what's going on in the world, and then the countries that are producing those goods will benefit or not benefit from them. So, international prices. Foreign aid. Africa actually receives, many of the developing countries are receiving large amounts of foreign aid for projects, for assistance from richer countries. That when those countries, when richer countries have a recession, you can be sure they cut back on their foreign aid. It always happens. So the pain gets transferred. Another thing, Africa, and like many low-income countries, has workers working in other places in the world. Typically, and this is not just Africa, but Asia, they go to more richer countries to work and send home money to their home country. That's a remittance, a worker's remittance. So when, under normal conditions, your workers from low-income countries are sending back money to their families, and this is substantial. And I can tell you there's many countries, well, we've got one next door, Zimbabwe. Lots of Zimbabweans here are sending money back to their families in Zimbabwe and keeping them afloat. If the economy in South Africa goes bad, those Zimbabweans here may be the first to lose their jobs. They're sending back less money. So again, this is how the world works, how we transfer. And these remittances are actually quite large. Foreign aid is quite large. These figures are, when you aggregate them at international levels, they're big numbers. Finally, let's shift over to financial transactions. Financial transactions, interest rates are very important. They're important when we have a world where money can move fairly freely from one area to another. And in that case, when we have what we call capital mobility, it's possible to move your money to London, to New York, you have a family there, you have a bank account. For interest rates make a difference, and when a country raises its interest rates, it tends to attract more capital and investments here. One of the factors that kept the rand very strong in the past couple of years was that in the United States and Europe, interest rates went down to almost zero. The 10-year Treasury bill rate in the United States, even today, is 2%. The 3-month the 1-year Treasury bill rate is less than 1%. And that's the Treasury bill rate. If you go to a bank in the United States, you can't get any interest on a savings account for any short period of time. So there are funds in the United States, emerging market funds, which collect people's money and invest it in places like South Africa. Of course, there's an exchange rate risk in that process. It's not free, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But clearly, you bring your money over at one exchange rate, you've got to take it back, and you hope the exchange rate is at least as favorable. But raising the interest tends to attract money. When more money comes in, it tends to strengthen your exchange rate. And strengthening your exchange rate, we talk about appreciating your exchange rate. So just keep that in. When the money comes in, your exchange rate appreciates. When the money goes out, your exchange rate weakens or depreciates. Now, I want to talk about something a little more sort of subtle and complicated, which are a lot of shocks are transmitted through companies and banks' balance sheets. I mean, once you understand some simple ideas, you'll see how this creates crises, and it's very relevant to what's happening today. Take a bank. Well, think about a bank. A bank collects deposits and makes loans. It can make a loan to people, a commercial loan, or if it makes a loan to the government, it buys a government bond. At the end of the day, its assets, those loans, better be larger than the deposits. Otherwise, some depositor, otherwise they don't have it, your money is missing. We call that the net worth. It's got to be greater than zero. And as part of that net worth, usually it's a good sized number, that net worth, and that's the bank's capital, the shareholder's capital, and what that net worth represents is the shareholder's capital and some reserves, which are the past profits of the bank. Now, what happens if a whole bunch of these loans go bad? Well, now these assets are shrinking, and that when those assets are shrinking, that net worth is shrinking. And if those assets go very bad, like a subprime crisis, like all of a sudden you're holding a lot of investment bonds, which negative net worth. That's a big problem. Negative net worth means the bank is now insolvent. You've got a serious problem because you couldn't pay off all your depositors. Not that people tend not to run and queue up at the bank so much anymore, but the bankers know it's a disaster. And we'll see when we talk about some crises, that's exactly what was happening to banks. When these loans go bad, you have negative net worth. And we'll talk about how you solve that problem. That, let me go back. That, by the way, bad loans is what we call commercial risk. It's the risk banks take when they make a loan. That's why banks are very difficult about making loans sometimes, because if they go bad, it represents a big threat to their network. But banks are in the business of doing that. So they're supposed to make loans and assess the risk. That's their business. Now I want to add in one other twist. So here's our bank's balance sheet. It's got its deposits. We'll imagine it's all in Rand, and it makes loans to businesses and the government. And this net worth, we'll call it the shareholders' capital. Now the bank says, oh, it starts to get very clever, and it says, look, I can borrow some dollars in the United States offshore very cheaply, because dollar interest rates are very cheap right now. I think I'll go borrow some dollars at 1% or 2%, and then I'll loan them out to all my customers here at 10 or 11%. Well, that's great, except there's one thing that we're forgetting about. They borrowed in dollars, and they loan it out in Rand, and assuming your customers pay back and everybody's happy, you still have to pay back those dollar loans and hope that that exchange rate doesn't move too much. If that exchange rate moves dramatically when the time comes to pay back the dollar loan, you've got this exchange rate valuation effect, which could be very negative here, and if that is very negative, it does the same thing as like bad loans. It reduces all the value of your assets, and then it reduces your shareholders' capital, and you're back to a potential crisis. And in fact, that is actually one of the stories of the East Asia crisis in 1997 and 1998. They found that exchange rate had been stable for a long time. Interest rates were very high in Asia, and dollar interest rates and euro interest rates were very low. And they started borrowing money like mad. And that thing went on for a couple of years, borrowing in a foreign currency and lending in a local currency. But they overdid it, and there was a major depreciation of the Thai baht in both of those currencies. We're talking about 25 to 50% devaluations, and that meant that all those borrowed funds became doubly expensive. It reduced the value of their assets dramatically. All of a sudden, the banks were becoming insolvent, like our previous story. But this is due, I'm citing